Hello, and I'm Matt McCord. Welcome to Talking Heads on this, our final program. Coming up on the program tonight, an embassy attack has occurred in Kabul, Afghanistan, as well as a parallel attack on Pakistan. And Kandahar Airport has also been attacked in Afghanistan. We'll be looking at the implications of this in the wider Middle East conflict. Ben Carson, back at home, is threatened to leave the Republican Party and run as a third-party candidate. Number three, Donald Trump has made in the past week some very inflammatory comments, one could say, about Muslims. And we'll be taking a look at exactly what that policy is and how, in any way, it could make sense. The Front National in France have made marked gains, while UKIP has actually lost some support in the United Kingdom in recent elections on the local level. Taking a look at that in the greater context of European Euroscepticism and anti-immigrant tides of opinion. Tony Blair has unloaded on Jeremy Corbyn, his successor as Labour Party leader, and also has discussed Muammar Gaddafi, taking a look at that. Russians and Syrians, so the Russians have made further threats to anyone interfering in what they claim to be their backyard. We'll be taking our usual look at that. IS oil trade has ballooned to $500 million by most estimates. Taking a look at that, of course. And finally, we'll wrap up with Ukraine coming full circle since our first program and a quick retrospective. That's all coming up on Talking Heads right now. It's 6:02. Well, hello, everyone. Happy Friday. It is the 11th of December, and this is our last 60-minute program, so let's make it count. Topic number one. Afghanistan and the current security situation in Afghanistan. Sam, you have been following this, so why don't you start us off?
Well, the current security situation in Afghanistan is that it's horrible. In the past week, there have been two more major Taliban attacks on kind of key Afghan facilities. And these haven't been necessarily kind of conquests, but they're big splash attacks. They get in the news and they make the government look weak. So earlier in the week, I believe on Tuesday, there was a bombing of some Taliban fighters disguised as Afghan security personnel infiltrated the Kandahar Airport, which is the largest which is one of the largest kind of military bases in Afghanistan, and kind of a key place because there's also still kind of American personnel stationed there at a base. So it's one of those big kind of secure facilities, and they were able to get through there. And then today there was a bombing and apparently a gunfight in the kind of embassy district of Kabul. And this Spanish police officer guarding a guest house near the Spanish embassy was killed in the attack. And apparently, I believe fighting is still ongoing there. They're still trying to root out the Taliban. So again, these kind of, 50 people were killed in Kandahar on Tuesday. But yeah, so these have been big attacks, kind of big headline jumping attacks. And it just shows kind of the weakness of the Afghan government and also kind of the resurgence of the Taliban now that kind of U.S. and NATO forces have been pulled out for the most part of the region.
Mm-hmm. And I remember once commented that Afghanistan was in such a security state that its presidency was effectively limited in control to Kabul, more or less. So, I mean, in the past several years, how has the situation changed?
Well, the Taliban has kind of been gaining in strength even as it's been having its own kind of internal problems, as we talked about last week. Mm-hmm. And the Afghan government is weaker without kind of the ground support of U.S. and NATO forces. So there are districts in Afghanistan controlled by the Taliban. There are regions where the Taliban has re-set up its own authority. And not just in, for example, their attack on the city of Kunduz earlier this year that had their large attack. That was very shocking. But kind of in smaller kind of regions of Afghanistan, the Taliban has kind of ejected the Afghan government. And that's kind of – it's very similar to what happened when the Soviet pulled out. You have kind of a fracturing, a splintering. The government slowly loses control, and the government stronghold is Kabul.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we still support the Afghan government. The Soviet-supported Afghan government, the Democratic Republic of Afghanistan, I believe it was called, fell after the Soviet Union collapsed, and the Russian Federation was no longer willing and able to support it. We're still supporting the Afghan government, but who knows for how long, who knows to what extent.
Mm-hmm. But just looking at the security situation specifically in Kabul, I mean, this has happened many times before, hasn't it?
Yes. I mean, it's not a secure city in that sense, not like we think of. It's not quite Baghdad in the 2000s, but...
Ouch.
So how does one solve this? Ladies, we'll start with you. Anyone?
I mean, I think Afghanistan is just in a really bad position on either side. The government hasn't been particularly effective, and the Taliban is going through some sort of weird, I don't know, fracturing or segmentation potentially, and also gaining in strength. So it's just a really, really terrible situation. I really don't know how you would solve it.
I think it's also interesting to mention that this attack happened right on the week that the Afghan president was supposed to meet with the Pakistani president to discuss support within the region for fighting the terrorist organization. But it seems like something that the Taliban is using to sort of show the weakness of the Afghan government. And if the forces in the area will be the only ones that will boost their support for the effort against the Taliban, then this doesn't bode well for the government, because I can't imagine the U.S. or other NATO countries just buffing up any power in the region either.
Mm-hmm. Sam, what's your take on how one would actually solve all this? So how do you think this ends? What's the end game here?
Destruction.
The probably the best case scenario end game is that we basically have Kabul and the regions around it, and maybe a few other kind of central cities such as Kandahar, for example, as kind of redoubts of under Afghan government control, and then the countryside belongs to the Taliban and other militant groups. And then you are able to negotiate some kind of general ceasefire that probably won't hold all the time, but will hold some of the time. And that there's a kind of relationship established between the Taliban and the Afghan government. Not necessarily in a power-sharing manner, but that they're able to do business with each other. Because Afghanistan doesn't have kind of a history of a strong centralized government. So it's much more built around kind of those regional and tribal and ethnic differences. So you have to kind of recognize that, and there needs to be a certain... If Afghanistan is going to be able to have even a small measure of peace, there has to be some kind of, not necessarily a federal system, but a decentralization of kind of government. And it will be chaotic, but that's kind of the nature of Afghanistan.
And that's impossible to overcome, you think?
In the short and middle term, yes. There is nothing to unify Afghans.
Okay.
As a group.
Okay. Socialist sisterhood, do you agree?
I mean, I kind of just feel like there's no happy ending for Afghanistan in all of this, at least not for a really long time.
I mean, they haven't had any peace for a very long time, and this brings us back down to, like, Western intervention and, like,
yeah,
like, would Afghanistan have been better off without it? Like, starting from the Soviets to, like, now, like, could things have been better?
And what's worrisome at this point is that if the Taliban is gaining momentum and ISIS is deciding to spread, this sort of weird mashup of terrorism could even go into Central Asia and possibly South Asia. I mean, it's already kind of in South Asia, Pakistan, and in India.
I mean, Pakistan happens to be in our part of the world, so
yeah, we already have terrorism. We have Taliban in India too.
I mean, Bangladesh, like, just being geographically isolated because of India, we get to, like, avoid that, but I mean,
and that is also important to remember, kind of when we discuss the Afghanistan situation, that traditionally Pakistan has been the biggest supporter and sponsor of the Taliban.
Much to our chagrin in foreign policy.
The Afghan government continues to blame Pakistan. So it's all going on this issue, and in some ways, Pakistan is the key to this, but Pakistan's own problem.
Okay, well, let's take a pivot for just a couple of moments over to the domestic political field. What fun, what fun. So Ben Carson has recently threatened to leave the Republican Party as what the Associated Press is describing as a nightmare potential scenario. And this is looking, we're looking at the threats of a splintering field. Remember, not too long ago, a couple of months ago, Donald Trump had to sign a commitment saying that he wouldn't depart from the Republican Party and run third party, but Ben Carson seems to be under no such obligation. He carries with him right now about 24% of the primary vote, depending on which poll at which you're looking. So that's a rather interesting development, and I've seen a good chunk of people saying, well, the Republican Party has brought this on themselves by abiding by these insurgent Republicans. So this looks like it's going to be a real mess. A third or fourth ticket run from either one of those candidates, if the convention goes brokered and we end up with a candidate Cruz or a candidate Rubio. I know Sam would like to see a candidate Cruz. It'd be his dream of dreams. But this is certainly interesting. But it looks to me like this whole pledge thing is just going completely out of control. I don't know. What's your collective take on it?
I mean, there's the whole, just slightly going to Trump before going to Carson again. I mean, Trump did say, like, earlier this month that it's a two-way street for him, because if the Republican, the RNC, if they decide to meddle in his nomination, he's going to, like, possibly go independent. And, like, he's been very, like, not very clear about what his stance on this is, despite what he might have signed. And I frankly don't know to trust anything Trump says at this point. And I mean, who knows?
I mean, a third party run by either Trump or Carson would be really terrible for the GOP. It's just going to split the votes, and I think it'll just be massively inconclusive.
Sam, what was it you were saying that you were reading a couple of hours ago about Trump possibly being a legitimate...
Yeah,
go on, please.
I was reading an interesting article on the BBC about that Trump is a Democratic Party kind of Trojan horse. But he's attempting to sabotage the Republican Party. There's apparently a month before Trump entered the race, he had a phone conversation with Bill Clinton. And nobody knows what the conversation was about, but there's been speculation. And it's pointed out that Trump has done the exact opposite of what he was attempting to do, which was to kind of broaden his appeal to authorities and soften rhetoric. Trump has done the exact opposite of that. And that basically he couldn't do the party that's kind of if Donald Trump was a provocateur, what would he be doing differently from what he is already doing? And the answer is nothing.
Yeah, exactly.
He's tearing the Republican Party apart.
Exactly, and his candidacy is making it impossible for electable Republicans to
exactly.
be put forward in moderate states. So this, it's a theory that makes sense.
He's taken away from kind of the negative press that the Democrats have been getting, like over Hillary Clinton's emails, over all kind of the policy issues currently happening, kind of all the problems in the world, kind of foreign affairs. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump kind of sucks all the air out of those conversations and makes it all about him.
I mean, theory has been around for a while, that Hillary and Donald are in cahoots. So, I mean they were really good friends, and he used to donate to the Democratic Party.
It's been around for a while, and if it's true, then that's... I'd have to applaud the Democrats for, you know, just pure, like, you know, genius manipulation of the system. But, like, and yeah, I mean, it is ridiculous because, you know, Trump is... Even Netanyahu thinks his ideas of Muslims are too, like, out there. He's, you know, Netanyahu is telling him to calm down with all the Islamophobia. So it would be interesting if that was the case. I don't know what I would do.
If Netanyahu tells you that your views on Muslims are too much, then you need to stop.
Yeah.
So, speaking of Donald Trump and Muslims, let's talk about topic number 3. Donald Trump going off about Muslim immigrants threatening to put a stop, first a full stop, and then, oh wait, I didn't mean that. I'm talking about a stop subject to the condition if you are an American citizen or a service member, then you're not stopped, but just Muslims in general being barred from entering the country. I think you can say goodbye to your student visa there, Shemaida.
I mean, that's the thing, though, like, how is it going to be feasible? Because there's so many people who are working here who are Muslims, and, like, I mean, it wouldn't be feasible in any sort of way.
We managed to do it with Iranians, and we managed to do that whole internment camp thing with the Japanese. So, like, I mean, you know, anything's possible, I guess.
Really, Scott?
I'm not supporting it, again. I'm just saying,
it's,
you know.
It's sad that you have to clarify every time.
It's sad that you always jump to conclusions that I am... that I'm supporting this.
I don't know. I think the fact that he's making the point is something that's there. I mean, we may all make fun of Donald Trump, but the horrifying, in my opinion, truth is that he has 35% of the primary vote on some polls still. And he's going to be a force to be reckoned with, even if he is a Trojan horse or whatever the heck he is. He's going to leave a mark on the party, for better or for worse. I think for worse, the party's going to go into obscurity if they keep this up. But he's still there, and, you know, his views are starting to become more and more of the Republican mainstream, which is in and of itself horrifying. Sam, you're going to say something?
I don't think, though, that this will kill the Republican Party. I mean, if you remember, though, back in 2008 when Obama won, and everybody, especially our good comrades at MSNBC, were discussing kind of, is this the end of the Republican Party? Is the beginning of kind of a new era. Will they be able to survive this horrible defeat?
KGNBC.
Well, then the Tea Party happened, and Republicans gained control of Congress, and yeah, so...
Well, right,
but a lot can change.
But let's think back to how the Republican Party weathered that storm. How did they weather it? They jumped pretty far to the right. The Tea Party happened. Grassroots, you know, paleo-conservative movements happened.
And Obamacare happened.
That is true, yes, but the fact is that the party had to jump to the right in order to at least field candidates, so...
Well, they just...
Post-Ergo Hot Propter Hog aside...
They won elections.
Mm-hmm, yes, but the fact is the party has jumped, undeniably jumped to the right of the left-right
spectrum.
Well,
the Democratic Party has jumped to the left, so... And there's no viable... party to go in the center.
We need a Lib Dem party. That would work well.
That's how the Liberal Party died, though. Once the Labor Party became a viable party, you had the Tories and you had Labor, and the Lib Dems were in the middle, and they got torn asunder.
Well, yeah, except for the part where Labor's jumped to the right and jumped to the right and jumped to the right. I mean, if the Democrats jumped to the left, the Republicans jumped to the right.
That's the same way that in the 90s, the Democrats in America jumped to the right.
So are you saying this is all just a cyclic thing? This will eventually bounce back? I mean, that's a fair
eventually,
point.
I mean,
but you need a catalyst.
Donald Trump could be a sign that the country, even now, is jumping to the right.
I mean, like...
He could be kind of a harbinger of that. You see kind of the protests on college campuses and things like that, and that's not necessarily a winning... Those aren't winning issues for the Democrats. Whenever kind of they let their left wing kind of start to go off the reservation, the American public in general tends to not appreciate that. You know, you have the silent majority, the Reagan Democrats, all of that. And that kind of group will, though it would be demographically different than it has been in previous elections, that group will kick in and the country will shift to the right as a reaction. So that could happen. Again, there are a lot of things that, I mean, politics changes with the wind.
I mean, like, looking at everything that's happening around the world with the terrorist attacks and everything, I mean, people have more reasons than ever to switch to, like, all these extremist views, because you need an answer to all your problems, and Trump seems to be an answer. And I don't see his comments in the previous week about Muslims deterring any of his fans from, like, voting for him, because I don't see any of his...
I don't see any comment that Donald Trump's ever made deterring any of his fans.
Yeah, I mean, this is
some
what
of his
people
polls are going
want.
Up now.
Yeah, this is what people want, and Donald Trump's going to sell this as long as he can.
And
Sam, you might want to check your network connection. I can barely hear you.
It might be the lovely Bishop Net too.
Sam, I'm going to try and get you back. Irvija, you were saying something?
And I was just saying that this is a trend that's been happening in the U.S. and in some Western European countries with this sort of rise in the right-wing popularity.
I mean, look at France.
Look at the U.K., so Germany. They're all scared.
I mean, this is the perfect time to breed nationalism and the whole idea of, like, the whole patriotic vibes and everything. Like, it's all coming back, and the Republicans are giving the people what the Democrats can't, which is a solution of some sort, whatever it may be.
Fear-mongering.
Yeah, fear-mongering.
People like that sort of, you know, boost, that sort of adrenaline rush of, you know, war brewing.
I mean, we have the perfect breeding grounds for xenophobia.
We do, and it's just horrifyingly sad.
It is.
But I mean, you know what? It's just how the world works. It's how, and it won't change. I don't think there's a solution for it anytime soon.
Well, I think we have Sam back. Sam, you back?
Hello?
There you go.
All
right. Beautiful. All right, so you're going to like this. So we're moving on to the European election results in local municipalities over the last few weeks. So let's start with the Front National. Front National in France actually won outright their local elections, 37-30-27, with the Socialists coming in third, I believe. Sam, am I correct?
I thought it was a little bit closer. I thought it was like 37-35-32. No, that's not right, because that's...
Sounds close.
The Front National was like the clear leader, and then you had the Republican Party, which is center right ish, and then you had the Socialist Party in last place, which is of course the ruling party of France.
So the rejection of Hollande, one could argue with that his approval rating's been in the toilet, and his prime minister, who's been three times more popular than he has suddenly completely discounted a block of voters. Do you still have that quote?
Oh, I do not think I do, unfortunately.
The French Prime Minister, who is seen as Hollande's heir apparent, made a rather wonderful quote. Manuel Valls, I think, however you pronounce
yes.
it. Made a rather wonderful quote and disparaged half the electorate in so doing. But the Front National basically won that election. And in the last couple of years, they've come near to winning the European elections. They've come near to winning the presidency. So are we seeing the undeniable rise of the right wing to far right wing in France?
Yes.
You know what I'm going to ask you next? Why?
Well, I mean, there are a couple of reasons, and obviously kind of
I mean, there's the whole...
Since the Cold War, there have been the world, you know, we have a great future ahead of us, we can live in peace and harmony, everybody can be taken care of, and then the economy collapsed in 2008. And so these kind of traditional parties of Europe that ran kind of on the status quo now and said, you know, kind of told their citizens, well, we have all the answers. You have to trust the system. Well, the system failed. And now you have kind of the rise of kind of Islamic terror in the middle in Europe now is kind of demographics change. You have the migrant crisis. You have all these things. So people are afraid. People are unsure. People don't trust their governments. And you have the right wing these right wing populist parties saying, you know, because they are running economically as populists. You know, they're not kind of calling for austerity and things like that, like the kind of mainstream right wing parties are in general. They have a well tailored message to kind of the feelings of the European populace at the moment. They have a good mixture of policies that is obviously appealing to voters. So,
Shamini, you want to say something?
I mean, I was going to say the same thing. I mean, like, there's mass unemployment there, and, like, the economic state isn't particularly well, and with the migrant crisis, like, it's not, and, like, with the terrorist attacks and everything, it's the same case with America. It's not surprising that people want answers, people want the foreigners out, people want jobs. I mean,
people don't want the European Union or the established status quo in some cases.
Yeah, and, like, the Front National, and it seemed like, it, like, seems very odd, like, in how far right they are. Isn't, like, the founder, Jean-Marie Le Pen, like, didn't he do the whole, isn't he, like, anti-Semitic and, like, has been, like, known as the known
He's been tossed out of the party for it.
His daughter is being compared to Margaret Thatcher, though.
But he said the most awful thing about his daughter. He's like, why doesn't she get married and change her name already?
I think that
they had a wonderful family falling out.
Yeah.
As the parties become more and more electable,
the father
has been kicked more and more out.
Well, I mean, all for the best, hopefully. But I think what the interesting thing about France is how quick this sort of transition has been from the very left-leaning European socialist utopia policy to this very sudden rightist nationalist, you know, upsurge, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Well, to be fair, there's been kind of, in the past, the two kind of establishment parties, the Republican and the Socialist Party, have worked together to keep the Front National from winning elections and gaining seats and gaining kind of in a similar way. You have the Labour Party and the Tory Party work together to keep UKIP from gaining any seats in the last UK election, and they've done a similar thing to try to block them out.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of UKIP, so there was just a by-election in the UK, and despite the fact that UKIP has been relatively consistent on raw polling numbers, sitting at about 14% of the electorate, they just saw their by-election vote decrease by 2%. Now, Nigel Farage has gone on about how it was a rigged election and whatnot, which one wouldn't expect, but then again, it would seem to be right on form for Nigel Farage, if not for the other parties. So the Labour Party's kept that seat, something like 66% of the vote. It's a safe Labour seat. Yeah, but to be fair, a strong showing from UKIP would have put the main parties on edge as it had before, but we're seeing UKIP start to fall a little bit and people moving toward Corbyn as a more insurgent candidate. So what my question is, has Jeremy Corbyn taken out the insurgency support for UKIP? Is UKIP now no longer seen as the anti-establishment party?
Perhaps, but at the same time, you can buy what it wanted because getting a referendum on Europe. So kind of that's what its energy is going towards. The third highest amount of vote the last election. So it's focused it is like a single issue party basically. There's other kind of anti establishment rhetoric, but it is anti-EU, those are kind of the issues that are at the forefront in the UK. You know, Jeremy Corbyn has come in like this new very left-wing agenda. And so he's kind of taking the oxygen out a little bit. So I don't think that he's kind of overtaken the mantle of anti-establishment party just because Labor kept it safe seat. I don't think you can say that just off of that one election.
Mm-hmm. And just a quick note, we apologize for any technical difficulties we're having. There's a little wonderful mess up with BishopNet or with Sam's internet. We're not quite too sure
which. Our viewership is complaining.
Mm-hmm. So
really?
Really. So we do apologize for that, as we always do, on technical difficulties. We'll be trying to sort those out in the meantime. Urja Shimeda, do you have any other comments on UKIP?
Nah. I mean, just on a fun side factoid, didn't like the immigration spokesperson for UKIP, didn't he like run into like Jean-Marie Le Pen in some like European Union?
Yeah, he apparently hit him.
He apparently like walked past him and like
and
hit
pushed him,
and then got like pushed off by Le Pen's
security.
Well, one should expect this. It is the European Parliament. This is a regular occurrence.
He apparently apologized because he was kicking a journalist and not Le Pen.
That's always okay.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
Oh God, politicians and journalists. That's
oh, please, let's not even go to Tony Blair yet.
Oh, we aren't on Tony Blair yet. But speaking of which, coming up on the program still, on this, our final 30 minutes, we'll be taking a look at some Latin American upheaval. Tony Blair talking about Muammar Gaddafi and Jeremy Corbyn. That was a lot of fun to read. The Russians and continuing their stance in Syria, as well as IS's oil trade. That one will be interesting to watch. And we'll finally be ending with Ukraine coming really full circle since our first broadcast. We'll be looking more into that. This is Talking Heads on OWU Radio. All right, so let's move forward into, let's talk about this Latin American election stuff. So for everyone's benefit in here, the president of Argentina, Fernandez de Kirchner, I believe, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, has just been trounced, or at least her party has been trounced in the polls, and she's been booted out of office, and the center-right has come to power in Argentina for the first time in a long time. I can't remember how long.
Since the return to democracy.
Yeah, this is...
83, 83?
So the first time a non-explicitly Peronist party has actually gotten the nod. In addition to that, we're also looking in Venezuela, where the Venezuelan socialists and communists effectively got booted out of office, and there's now a supermajority for a united front of center-left to right-wing parties that are just anti-government. So an anti-government, pro-democracy coalition, if you take them at their word on that, has come to legislative but not presidential power in Venezuela. So let's take a look at these taken... Well, let's first take a look at Argentina. So President de Kirchner's out. I can say after talking to several Argentinians, much of that was potentially due to the complaints over how she's run the country, over how she's managed affairs, and apparently lack of managing affairs in favor of blaming everything on the Falklands, according to one certain Argentinian common friend of ours here. So let's start this off. What are we thinking of this? Are we thinking this is the rise of the center-right in Latin America, a place that hasn't been seen in generations?
It's obviously the rise of kind of the right-wing party, kind of keeping with the rest of kind of the world's attitude. However, I would say this is a little bit more of not so much an election of the right, but rather kind of a rebuke of the long-established left-wing parties in South America, because they have been in power, the socialists have been in power in Venezuela for 16 years,
mm-hmm.
and then various left-wing kind of governments have ruled in Argentina since 83, like we said. So, and obviously things haven't gone too well for them. I mean, in Venezuela, they don't even have, have heart valves to do heart transplants and things like that. Their medical system is completely collapsing. And people, and you know, the basic kind of government services that they've promised to their people, they're not able to deliver on in Venezuela. And so the people are mad. And they have ruled in a very authoritarian manner in Venezuela. Now, in Argentina, there are larger kind of structural problems. Their economy has been ailing for decades, and the left-wing government haven't really been able to fix that. I mean, they just, there's that whole court in New York over kind of Argentina on its death. So the ongoing issues, there's a feeling that it's mismanaged. Like Matt said, they've mismanaged this. So people are mad about mismanagement, not necessarily that they completely agree with the right-wing parties and all of their policies. It's more that they need to change.
All right, because so rebuke.
That's a rebuke.
So rebuke of the interesting parties, which is interesting. Also interesting you mentioned Brazil, because the incumbent president, Dilma Rousseff, is having some own troubles of her own with corruption scandals bringing her popularity down to, what, 35%?
Yeah, I believe so. Over what, an oil company, correct?
Mm-hmm. Over her connections with an oil company.
Yeah. I mean, it's South America. Kind of. Corruption is part of the system there.
Comments, ladies? All right, they're apparently beside themselves with laughter for some reason. So, yeah, I think it's an interesting point about this, because, as you mentioned, the center-left parties have been in power for decades. In Mexico, they've been in power virtually uninterrupted. I mean, the last decade was the first decade in which they were effectively challenged in years. I want to say since the early 1920s or late 1910s.
Since the revolution.
Yeah.
Since kind of the Mexican Revolution and all of the civil wars that happened. Anti-church kind of left-wing party.
Yeah, since they effectively had universalized suffrage in Mexico, and even at some point before that, the PRI has been the institution of power.
Yeah, exactly. And only recently has there been a right-wing party.
Mm-hmm, and in many of these Latin American countries, it's been much that way for years. So there's been the institutions of power, the institutions of the left wing. So that was certainly interesting. Any of y'all have further comments on this?
No.
All right, well, let's move forward into Tony Blair, or Tony Bear, as he is affectionately known. Tony Blair has recently made some rather interesting statements on multiple things. The first thing he said was about Jeremy Corbyn. Do you have that quote? If not, I'm going to pull it up, Sam. If you don't have it, I'll have it.
I found the quote from the Prime Minister of France.
What did he say?
He said that a win for the nationale could lead to civil war in France.
Yeah, civil war. Hyperbole?
Hyperbole.
You could ask a multiple choice question, it would be self-demonstrating. So, Tony Blair has called Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party a fringe protest movement, and calling Labour's current position a tragedy, in that the party no longer aspires to government.
Oh, wow.
Fighting words from the former Prime Minister, who once led the party to 3 election victories, and a landslide victory. I mean, the most successful Labour leader that anyone's ever had in Britain.
Yeah.
But also looking at what he said about the Gaddafis, Sam, do you have that quote?
He admitted that during kind of the Libyan revolution in 2011, he had two kind of long phone calls with Muammar Gaddafi, kind of talking with him, and he said that he was not giving him kind of advice on how to stay in power. He was advising him to leave the country, and basically create a peaceful transition.
Yes, he was not trying to save the colonel.
Yes, he wasn't trying to save him. He was trying to kind of bring peace to Libya. And I mean, that's kind of the irony of all of this, is that Gaddafi actually had reestablished relations with kind of the West. He gave up his kind of nuclear and chemical programs. We reestablished diplomatic contact. And Tony Blair and George W. Bush were instrumental in that.
Mm-hmm. But we're still not besties with them, so we're not at that time. It's definitely fair to say.
Relations were improving until Obama decided to get rid of Gaddafi.
But we were doing that to protect civilians from airstrikes, don't you remember?
Quote
unquote. Oh, yes, because it's better when ISIS is in charge.
Mm-hmm. Well, apparently the transitional parliaments have finally agreed to reconcile. Yes. They've agreed to reconcile and hold elections within 2 years, so we've got that to look forward to. Hopefully they'll be able to do it. I'm not too sure myself that they will. But apparently they've tried reconciling. We'll see how that works in the coming days. But rather interesting what he's saying about Jeremy Corbyn as well, a complete repudiation of the Labour leader. I think someone's tired of losing general elections, but...
And I mean, they just come from opposite ends of the Liberal, or of the Labour Party.
Yeah, Tony Blair is really sort of a Tory when you get right down to it. I mean, there's not much separating him from John Major.
In the 90s, Tony Blair was shifting to the right, similar to how Bill Clinton shifted to the right. That's what allowed Labour to finally win elections.
Mm-hmm.
After kind of over a decade in the wilderness, Margaret Thatcher and then John Major was in power.
The wilderness, absolutely. And just looking at where Labour is sitting in the polls right now, they may be facing another 10 years in the wilderness. They're looking at this Conservatives are up to 41% from 36% at the last election, and Labour has fallen about a percentage point. And the Liberal Democrats have been the real losers. They've lost what little support they had left. So is this – I mean, it looks to me like it's a British repudiation of Corbyn, at least on the polls. But it also, again, the Labour Party has gotten a great number of their supporters back. So is this necessarily a complete repudiation from the public? I don't think so. It doesn't look like that. They've gotten a good chunk of the anti-establishment vote.
I would say it's not that they've gotten the anti-establishment vote. It's that they've gotten all of the Green Party supporters, all of the Liberal Democrat supporters, all of the college students, all of the kind of left-wing intelligentsia. They have all now flocked to the banner of Labour now that Corbyn is in charge because he shares their policy views.
Like Bernie Sanders?
Like Bernie Sanders. In a way that Labour leaders haven't in the past. Labour has always tried. History is as a radical left-wing party. They're always trying to push themselves to the center, to appeal to everyone. Whereas... this new Labour Party that Jeremy Corbyn is attempting to build is kind of going to the left. And that's usually not – going to the left usually isn't how it
works. Apologies for the sound difficulty there. what is your take on this socialist intelligentsia of over radio?
that's low, Matt.
Sorry, social democrats.
I was actually thinking more about what he said on Gaddafi.
Mm-hmm.
He basically just humble bragged and denied all the things that went wrong. That's all I got from reading what he said.
I mean, especially when he said that the game was worth it, but that does not mean I approve of the way he ran his country. I had the hope, probably misplaced, that he would engage in political and economic reform. Sure.
And he basically said that he was the one that led to Libya not having chemical weapons. I mean, sure, he can take some credit on that, but...
But then again,
they were scared of being invaded like Iraq.
Well, look where it got them.
Yes, but yet again, force does have gets a certain response from people internationally.
I mean, he's not wrong. I don't agree with him, but he's not wrong.
Beautifully put. But,
if only the world worked that way, Gorbachev.
Leave me in my idealism.
Okay, well...
I don't think there's any doubt that getting rid of Gaddafi was a disaster. I mean, that is how this migrant crisis started.
It was a disaster.
Well, at least one migrant crisis. It seems like if Europe isn't having one migrant crisis, they're having another.
A good portion of them are coming from Libya, though. And Gaddafi even said that before we kicked him out. Before we killed him, really. But yeah, dictators do bring stability, the same as Saddam Hussein. They're not nice, Bashar al-Assad, they're not nice people, but they do keep a lid on the tension.
Mm-hmm.
Resident fascist.
No, that's real. That's realism.
No, she was looking at Scott.
There's more than one.
I mean,
that's realism.
Yeah, I agree with what Sam has to say. I mean, you know, these strong leaders are people that can, you know, they can keep their people in order. What is it? I was just about to. Never mind.
All right.
I was
well,
thinking about Horace.
Oh dear.
Headphones.
My apologies for that. So let's move forward. Provided no one else is saying anything. There we go. Let's move forward into Russians in Syria. So this has been a favorite topic for, the last forever we've run this show as we wind into our last 14 minutes.
Didn't Putin accidentally or, like, not mean to say that that the Russian army was supporting the Free Syrian Army, the FSA? And then the Kremlin said something completely opposite. They're like, no, we're still supporting the government and blah, 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 blah,
yeah.
blah.
Yeah, I think that might have been like a...
That's just misinformation.
It sounds like good old-fashioned Russian misinformation
to me. Yeah, it's strategic deception. The Russians have always tried to practice that in kind of foreign affairs and kind of as a military strategy.
Well, exactly.
So they tell you multiple things, so then you can't be sure.
Well, I don't think I've ever seen a better player at strategic misinformation than the Russians. So I don't know if that claim has any credence. They have no incentive to actually ally with the FSA, because the FSA wants to see Bashar al-Assad gone, and the Russians don't want to see that. Bashar al-Assad has been one of their great allies. Syria
Assad doesn't have to go in order for them to negotiate. They will negotiate with Assad.
Yeah. Also, what's interesting is how, you know, Putin is now saying that, yeah, like, you know, we have to leave Assad to deal with this problem himself. We can't help him out. But now we see Iran that's slowly integrating more and more forces into the area. And so it's very clever of Putin to say that, because he has his pet doing all the work for him with Hezbollah and Iranian forces, which, you know. Props to Putin.
Always.
Yeah.
So, Sam, remind me, I think we're talking about this. It's sort of an interesting set. Didn't both Dr. Paul and Nigel Farage get pilloried for saying that the world leader that they admired most was collectively Vladimir Putin?
I believe so, yeah.
They both got slammed with that, and yet... Here we are. He said he'll leave by 2024. He's got more longevity than any U.S. president I can ever think of.
2024?
Yes, 2024 is when he said he'll retire. After another switcheroo.
He hasn't placed his brain into some cyborg and decides to run Russia that way.
It's not outside the realm of possibility, except for the part where that doesn't exist yet.
I mean, there is no political opposition that is noteworthy.
There
isn't.
There is no worthy political opposition to Vladimir Putin. Mikhail Gorbachev's party has 0% of the vote, and they're the only social democrats around. The rest of it are the hardline communists and the far-right nationalists whose policy ideas include blowing nuclear waste in neighboring countries.
And then, what are they called? The Nationalist Party, the right-wing party, was created by the Kremlin as a kind of
allegedly, they still deny it.
As a strawman right-wing party. Just as the same way the official opposition is the Communist Party, but they vote with the government on many, many issues.
It's Russia.
Aren't Russian politics wonderful?
And, like, that's the thing, Putin never fails to impress, but, like, I shudder to think what will happen to Russia once he's gone, though. Like
Dmitry Medvedev, you switch between a bald man and a not bald man, and you just
keep
going.
Is what Russia does. Yeah, bald. Yeah.
And I mean, Dmitry Medvedev is the heir apparent, and he seems to have a good chunk of Vladimir Putin's foreign policy intelligence. Not quite all of it, I would say, but just based on what I've seen,
he seems
to be reasonably
he
competent.
He is nowhere near as deceitful or charismatic. Neither.
She says with admiration glowing in her eyes.
No.
Well, if you think about it as a long-term Russian strategy, look at Dmitry Medvedev's good relations with Barack Obama. Look how friendly they were. Look how buddy-buddy they were. And then Putin comes in and this happens again, that they use some strategic deception on Obama in that sense.
Well, because Obama was threatening their strategic interests at that point. During Medvedev's term,
exactly.
There wasn't a threat. We were working rather well together on many areas, but
suddenly... Yeah, exactly. And Medvedev got Obama to not put the missiles in Poland.
Definitely be interesting to see.
They got it for free. Russia got it for free. We didn't get anything out of that deal. Obama just let them have it. Which, again...
Mm-hmm. It'll definitely be interesting to see what the end game looks like on this. But let's pivot, since we've only got about 9 minutes left until we're off air. And the off air sign flashes up. Let's talk about Ukraine. Speaking of Russians, that's really come full circle since the beginning of this program. Sam and I were just watching the Ukrainian parliament descending into a fracas once again as one government coalition member attacked the prime minister. So it was one of the Poroshenko bloc members attacked the prime minister, who is leader of the second bloc, the parliamentary bloc. I think so.
I believe that's his name.
But in any case, they're coalition partners, and the president's party member came up and attacked the prime minister, tried dragging him away from the podium, and what often happens in Ukrainian politics whenever anything happens on the floor is that there's an immediate fist fight that follows and the sitting is suspended, which did happen in this case.
But
we're looking at that, and also reminded of the fact that there's such a huge demographic split in Ukraine. I mean, this country seems to be falling apart.
It's pretty hard not to argue that Ukraine is a failed state. I mean, they can't get a build kind of an effective governing coalition. There's too much kind of corruption, too much kind of the parties are too territorial. Everybody wants their little piece of the pie. There are too many kind of different interests involved, too many oligarchs. Very, very much kind of opposed. So the problem with those. There are similar problems in Russia, but Russia is a larger country with more of a kind of consensus. Russians have an identity that they don't necessarily have, because Ukraine has not historically been a country.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike Russia, there is nothing to go back to, and you see that in the split, the east-west split between kind of where in the west Ukrainians see themselves as Europeans, in the east they see themselves as Russians. And that's kind of a serious problem. And the government has not fixed any of the problems that they pledged to when they took power a few years back.
And if anything, the pro-Putin factions, the pro-Russian factions, have gotten even more credibility on that. They've found their message more salient in places,
exactly.
Obviously, like Crimea and like the rest of eastern Ukraine.
I mean, I'm just thinking of it from Russia's point of view, and like, I mean,
as you would.
I mean, just saying, like, Ukraine getting into the EU as, like, most of the younger generation seems to want it to be. Like, I don't see, like, how Putin would ever allow it, because, like, it wouldn't want NATO forces that close to the border. And
exactly.
Yeah, and,
there,
like, this would not be in Putin's best interest. And, frankly, I don't think Ukraine has the guts to actually, like, detach from Putin that way when such a huge part of their population still wants to, like, go back, essentially.
I mean, Ukraine is never going to get NATO protection. The EU or the US will never take that big of a risk. Ukraine's way too reminiscent of the Cold War again.
Well, I mean, looking at it from the Russian point of view, along with the resident Russian, this would make sense. Because, effectively, what happened the last time the Russians tried having an incursion this close to American soil? Cuba. Oh.
I mean, they negotiated on the bases in Turkey and things got sorted out.
Yeah, but the Russians backed down that time.
Mm-hmm.
Thankfully. They wouldn't back down for Ukraine.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's too close
how would
to
we
home.
Feel if China made it a strategic alliance with Mexico? You're protecting your sphere of influence, and Ukraine has traditionally been a part of Russia. So,
Yeah, I mean, it was the original home of the Russian people, yeah, if you exactly. go back far the enough.
Kievan roots, yeah. Russia started in Ukraine.
Well, then it's sort of an odd construct. It's been part of Poland, it's been part of Austria-Hungary, it's been part of Russia. It's been part of everything, virtually. And as a result, it's not an ethnically cohesive country. It's more of like a loose confederation of various peoples.
For a long time, Ukrainians used to be known as Ruthenians. For the most part, most Ukrainians were referred to as Ruthenians. They're just seen as kind of an eastern group of Poles. They were kind of a southern Poles, not actually until the Austro-Hungarian Empire had.
I think we might have lost you again. Okay, you're back. Are you there?
The Austro-Hungarian Empire had each of their kind of crown princes adopt one of their kind of subject cultures. And they basically created Ukrainian culture. Ukrainian had kind of grew this kind of cultural and ethnic kind of identity for themselves because of the Austro-Hungarians attempting to tie them closely to their own empire. And that, of course, didn't work, but until then, they were under the control of various places, but most of Ukraine is controlled by Russia historically.
Mm-hmm. So we're now coming up on the closing few minutes. Let's do one final and finally. So once again, just a 10-second brain teaser question. Who will end up being the Republican nominee? 10 seconds, let's start with Sam, and then we'll go around the table from my left.
I think, unfortunately, Ted Cruz. He will end up being kind of the compromise candidate between kind of the insurgents and the establishment.
Mm-hmm.
Which is unfortunate.
Irvija?
I'd agree with that. I think he's the most moderate in the Republican Party right now. The most likely, also.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if the convention isn't brokered or anything, like, and Trump gets away with it, Trump. If not, I'd agree with the Ted Cruz thing.
I really hope Trump doesn't have a chance, though.
And I'd say either Mark Rubio or Ted Cruz. Those are the only options aside from Trump.
Okay. Well, we're now drawing in on the final couple of minutes here. So in closing, I would just like to say first, thank you to everyone who's been on our program, to Ms. Irvija Rishi, to Shemaita Raman, and to Scott Payne for being our guest for the last couple of weeks, to Sam Barnett for helping me put this thing together for the last several weeks and being a program editor for now a year now. Also like to pay the appropriate copyright acknowledgement this time to KPM Media, to David Graham Hewson, and to Ankos Tomenka for our music service, as well as to all the OU Radio staff, including its general manager and program directors. And with that, that is it. We're now coming up on the last minute here, and I would just like to say thank you all very much for listening in.
Thank you to the viewers.
Yes, thank you to all of our viewers. But at any rate, it's now 59 minutes after. There will be more programs coming up here on OU Radio throughout the night. But from us, good night and goodbye. And